Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Welcome to the first show of 2010. And this is a year that I've called the Year of Resistance. We're going to have so much action and activity this year. It's going to be hard to continue the soapbox, to squeeze it in. But trust me, we're going to make every effort to have a new show for you every week. I'll be all over the world again in 2010 and in 2010, but we're going to make this radio show a top priority because it is part of the resistance. Our guest today is Venezuelan-American Eva Golinger. We'll be right back to chat about the empire, the U.S. empire, from a southern perspective. Stay tuned. This is Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan.
Cindy Sheehan's new ebook, Myth America 2, further examines two distinct classes of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama has declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who tragically send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose jobs and homes due to robber class graft. The robber class controls our government, and as Cindy says, we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. With pinpoint accuracy, humor, and in layperson's terms, Cindy Sheehan shows us why we should no longer be codependent with the robber class. To obtain a copy of Myth America 2, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you are listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Our guest today is Eva Golinger. She's the winner of the International Award for Journalism in Mexico in 2009. She was named La Novia de Venezuela, the girlfriend or sweetheart of Venezuela, by President Hugo Chavez. She's a Venezuelan-American attorney from New York. She now lives in Caracas. She's the author of many books, but her first book, The Chavez Code, has been translated and published in 6 languages, English, Spanish, French, German, Italian, and Russian, and is presently being made into a feature film. She's been researching U.S. interventionism in Venezuela and Latin America using the Freedom of Information Act and many other tools. Eva, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you very much.
You're speaking to us from Caracas, Venezuela, and it's warm down there, huh?
That's right. Well, it's actually always warm down here.
That's right. And we're having a cold spell here in most of the United States. But let's get right into the interview. I'm very honored to have you on today. When I was down in Venezuela in 2005, I was able to meet you. And, you know, at that time, I had a working person's knowledge of what's happening in South America, what's happening in Venezuela since 2000, and I think maybe it was 2006, the World Social Forum. I have, you know, been able to do a lot more studying. One time I was on MSNBC Hardball with a correspondent here named Nora O'Donnell, and she introduced me as the woman who has met with communist dictator Hugo Chavez. So I'd like you to talk about the communist part and the dictator part and explain it to my listeners, because many people on the left have that misconception.
Precisely, they have that misconception because of how mass media has distorted and manipulated and generally lied about what's really happening here in Venezuela. And of course, most of that is due to interests, you know, corporate interests as well as commercial interests, government interests coming out of the United States. In the case of Venezuela, just really brief history, I mean, which is important to understand why, you know, the mass media and even the U.S. government would be taking such a hostile and aggressive position against the government of Hugo Chavez. Venezuela is a very wealthy country in oil and gas reserves. It's actually one of the largest oil producers in the world. It has over 24% of oil reserves in the entire world. That's a lot for a country of 27 million people. And, of course, it's right close to the United States. I mean, we're in the same hemisphere. It's the port of South America. It's only two and a half hours approximately to fly to Miami. And, in fact, Venezuela's maritime territory borders U.S. territory, borders the colony of Puerto Rico. And so this is a very strategic place. And traditionally, there have been governments before Hugo Chavez who were subservient to U.S. interests. And in fact, over the years, the 40 years after the fall of the last dictatorship in 1958, pretty much the governments here in place were clients of the United States. It was a client state. And by the time Chavez went to power in 1998, Venezuela had pretty much privatized most of its industries that had been public industries, you know, including communications, electricity, basic social services, healthcare, and the oil industry was on its way to being privatized, and of course, could be privatized and handed over to U.S. corporations. So when Chavez comes to power, he changes all of that, and he actually wins with a huge majority in 1998, coming out of also a two-party system that his candidacy broke with. So very similar to the U.S. in that sense. And, you know, there's a two-party system and a stronghold on power here. So Chavez breaks through that, and, you know, the majority of Venezuelans voted for him precisely because they were tired and sick of the old corrupt system that had just increased poverty and was basically destroying the country and the infrastructure. So this all begins to change when he takes power. And, of course, that affects different interests. I mean, new laws are implemented regarding land reform, regarding, you know, the redistribution of the oil wealth and the whole hydrocarbons industry. And this begins to affect really powerful interests, not just in Venezuela, but outside of Venezuela. And then over as the years progress and Chavez himself gains more popularity outside of Venezuela and takes on a discourse that's much more anti-imperialist and nationalist at the same time, but also, you know, more socialistic, more humanistic. This begins again then to sort of resuscitate all these old demons that the U.S. government and the people of the U.S. still hold very tightly regarding concepts of socialism and communism, particularly in this hemisphere. And, you know, after all the prior decades, throughout the 20th century, where the U.S., you know, fought bitterly the rise of communism in this hemisphere and has blockaded inhumanely Cuba for over 50 years and tried to isolate and prevent, you know, and install dictatorships throughout the rest of the region in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s in order to prevent the spread of communism. Now here we have a government in the 21st century with all this oil wealth, this tremendous popularity, talking again about, you know, implementing a system that prioritizes social needs and redistributing the wealth, you know, and all these things, and at the same time maintaining its tremendous oil production and then branching out with its relations not just to the United States but also to other countries in the world like China, like Russia, Iran, that are, in the end are helping to change the balance of power and to lessen the influence and control of U.S. empire over the world. So, you know, all of this obviously affects tremendously these powerful interests inside the United States particularly, but around the world. And they've used their media power, particularly in control, to try to demonize the image of President Chavez. It's much easier to try to remove a president from power or encourage regime change in a country if you can say that that head of state that you want to overthrow is a terrible person, is a demon, is doing awful things, is a dictator, you know. And so that's part of what this campaign against the person of Hugo Chavez in the international media has really been about. I mean, in the end, here, and I've been living now in Caracas for over 5 years, and I can tell you this is the furthest thing from any kind of dictatorship. It's also not a communist state whatsoever.
Right.
And in fact, you know, we're on a path to implementing a new sort of social model that we're calling socialism of the 21st century, but it's really a combination of capitalism and socialism and trying to figure out what works best and fits here in Venezuela.
Yeah, kind of a humanist capitalism, I would kind of label it that way. Well, when I was on that show and during the break after Nora O'Donnell introduced me that way, I told her, I said, you know, President Chavez is not a communist and he's not a dictator. And she told me, well, we know that, but we had a meeting. We decided to call him that anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know.
Right. I mean,
It's a planned, concerted effort to demonize somebody like you say who tells the truth. Now, we know that President Chavez has been very popular for criticizing the Bush administration. In fact, calling George Bush Mr. Danger and very rightly pointing out the spread of this corporate empire. But President Chavez hasn't really fallen in love or been hypnotized by what I call hypnotized by the Obama administration, has he?
Well, initially, of course, as all throughout the world, there was some Obama mania down here as well and throughout all of Latin America. And there was a lot of caution in the beginning of 2009 when Obama was, you know, came to power and was elected and was sworn in and inaugurated into the presidency. There was caution as to continue the same type of discourse denouncing U.S. empire so strongly as it had been done during the Bush years, more so because of how it would impact world opinion, because so many countries around the world, and of course the mass media, had fallen in love with Obama. So anyone who would criticize Obama would, of course, be camped with the extreme right-wingers or, you know, people that presented some kind of threat, in fact, towards Obama himself. There was a lot of concern about that as well, that if, you know, from Venezuela, if the president comes out attacking Obama and something happens to him, they're going to blame it on us down here or something like that. So, yes, there was caution initially. I think there even was, and my own very perception, being also a U.S. citizen living down here and a Venezuelan citizen, but, you know, noticing how there was definitely that hope. It certainly did exist here, to put it in simple terms. I mean, not amongst myself or many others that are well aware that there's no change in U.S. empire. But, yeah, there was. And a lot of it was more due to Obama's skin color. I mean, and of course, his discourse, his poetic discourse and reaching out his hand or tending his hand, things like that. I mean, there was hope that maybe there would be some kind of change. And, in fact, I remember at the time of his election, I was one of the only voices down here in Venezuela who, you know, openly sort of rejected and just deconstructed the Obama mania and what his image really represented, and that it was really just a continuation of the same U.S. empire. But as the year progressed, as 2009 progressed, certainly, with the coup in Honduras on June 28th, and then the military agreement between the U.S. and Colombia to install a U.S. military bases right next door to Venezuela, all of that whole masquerade of Obama and his hope and change began to fall. And now it's completely gone. I mean, yeah, now everyone knows there's no more, you know, hoping and waiting and hoping that there's going to be some kind of change in the U.S. I mean, people see it for what it is. You know, there was a moment where people thought, yeah, it could happen. It's happening here. I mean, that's part of it is, unlike people in the U.S., Venezuelans have now lived through a change like maybe some people wanted or hoped would happen with Obama. We've gone through it here. It has happened. So, you know, there was sort of a vision that maybe it really is possible. Those of us who come from the U.S. and know really how it works know that that was not probably going to happen. and it hasn't.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, many people who live here in the U.S. don't realize how it works. But I saw, you know, Obama gave that speech, and it was just a speech in Cairo, reaching an olive branch out to the Islamic Arab world. And, of course, he has been responsible for increasing the level of troops and violence in the Middle East, now extending to Yemen and Pakistan and, you know, many other places, increases that George Bush didn't even have happen. But I never, ever saw him extend any kind of an olive branch to Latin America in his campaign or since he's been president. And, you know, as a matter of fact, he seems to be continuing that doctrine that the United States actually owns Latin America or something.
That's right, actually. Well, he did make some statement at the Summit of the Americas in the spring of 2009, trying to improve the relations with Latin American countries, but a lot of it was fluff. I mean, it was really just the speeches that had been written for him by his speechwriters
right.
to make it sound good and not look bad in front of, you know, Hugo Chavez and other representatives, Evo Morales from Bolivia and, you know, others that haven't had the best relations with the U.S. over the past several years. At the same time, yeah, I mean, the most obvious sort of examples of how relations have gotten worse with Latin America and how actually my opinion, also as someone who's been following and investigating and analyzing U.S. aggression and U.S. policies in Latin America over the past decade, my opinion is that Obama's administration is much more dangerous towards Latin America than Bush's was.
Right.
Because with Bush, we didn't have military bases, you know, being built throughout this region right next to Venezuela. I mean, there's been a rapid sort of escalation in the aggression towards particularly Venezuela, but also Cuba. I mean, Obama did talk about somehow changing U.S. policy towards Cuba, but he what he's done is make it worse, you know, make it much more aggressive and violent and hostile towards Cuba, and in many ways is using certain words to try to distract what the actions that his administration are really doing. And, you know, particularly, and then again, we have the case of the coup in Honduras
right.
against President Zelaya. I mean, that was a total, you know, scheme concocted by Washington and its allies, of course, of the right wing and the economic elite in Honduras and the multinationals. Yet they used what they call the smart power, you know, Hillary Clinton's and Obama's new sort of strategy as opposed to soft power and hard power, smart power, to confuse a lot of the heads of state in the region, media. I mean, they used a different discourse condemning a coup, but then, you know, not pushing really for the reinstatement of President Zelaya. I mean, all kinds of things and really just buying time. And
right.
a process that went on for so long that, you know, the coup eventually was consolidated. The U.S. in the end stepped forward as pretty much the only country that's recognized an illegal government in Honduras and is funding it and supporting it. And now it's all come out. But in those first few months, you know, a lot of people were very wary to blame the Obama administration on any role in that coup in Honduras, which is incredible because there hasn't been one single coup d'etat in Latin America throughout history that hasn't been somehow managed and ordered by Washington. So
by the CIA.
You know, why would that
yes.
change under Obama?
Right. Let's talk yeah. about that a little bit. We have a series of events that have happened in Cuba. The Cubans are accusing this person from an organization called DAI of being a spy, and they've detained him. In Venezuela, we've had reports of drones flying over Venezuelan airspace. And then in Afghanistan recently, we had 8 CIA contractors or operatives executed or assassinated or killed. And you, in your blog, you have a blog called Postcards from the Revolution that I would really encourage people to go look at. But in your blog, you made a connection of, you know, of all these events. Can you tell my listeners what that connection is and explain the series of events that happened?
Yes. Development Alternatives, Inc., DAI, is a major U.S. government contractor, mainly conducting activities relating to what I call subversion and counterinsurgency, what they call promoting democracy abroad. And they've been handling in Venezuela an office of the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, since 2002 that was set up after a coup here against President Chavez, and it's called the Office for Transition Initiative. So it's an office, it's a whole operation dedicated to, you know, promoting regime change here in Venezuela through other mechanisms other than the failed coup d'etat. And so I've been following, investigating them here now for years and their activities here in Venezuela, and they've been funding with approximately now about $50 million over the past 7 years, the opposition here in Venezuela to President Chavez, their political parties, their NGOs, their campaigns, their candidates. You know, I mean, we're talking major U.S. intervention. It's just it's a different kind. I mean, it's less visible. You know, I call it sometimes the sort of the silent intervention. And what I found interesting was that on last December 13th, the New York Times wrote an article about a U.S. citizen contractor, a contractor from the U.S. who had been detained in Cuba. And as it turned out, he was working for this company, this U.S. government contractor, Development Alternatives, Inc., that in fact, Development Alternatives, Inc. had gotten also, during 2008, so had begun working in 2009 under a contract also with USAID and other U.S. government agencies to promote transition, regime change in Cuba. And so this person was caught red-handed in Cuba distributing high-level satellite equipment to Cuban counter-revolutionaries and others to, you know, to engage in some kind of clandestine operation there, and he was detained. So those two, you know, the Venezuela-Cuba connection was easy to make with this company. And it seems as though the person that has been detained in Cuba, his name hasn't been released, but information I've obtained from inside sources do confirm that it's one of the same individuals, high level, that's been in charge of the Venezuela operation as well. When the CIA killings occur in Afghanistan on December 30th, it came out that also 15 days before, five contractors of this same company, Development Alternatives, Inc., had also been assassinated. And then in the killings on December 30th, there was talk of contractors in addition to CIA officers that had been killed in that attack in Coast. And actually on DAI's website, they have a statement about the December 15th killings, which received no attention,
right.
No media attention, mm-hmm. Which is incredible. Five U.S. citizens were killed in Afghanistan working for a USAID contractor that one would assume is not a CIA operation, yet nothing was said about it in the media. And, you know, my speculation is part of it has to do with the fact that one of their people was also detained in Cuba just days before the December 15th killing, and they didn't want to call attention anymore to that contractor precisely because it really is, you know, a cover for some kind of subversive activity to undermine democratic governments or governments in general that don't support U.S. agenda. What's most interesting, Cindy, is that article I wrote on my blog, on the blog Postcards from the Revolution, which is ChavezCode.com, I got contacted just a couple of days ago by the president of Development Alternatives, Inc.,
wow.
Who wanted to have a face-to-face meeting with me and discuss my article. And basically, you know, since I'm not having a face-to-face, I'm in Venezuela, he sent me several messages, and one of them basically was trying to intimidate me and accuse me of endangering DAI personnel by writing that article on my blog. And personally, I found that quite interesting that the president of one of the U.S. government's largest contractors with multi-billion-dollar government contracts around the world would even bother to contact little old me about an article written on a blog. I mean, it's not the New York Times, it's not the Washington Post, it's not the BBC. It's a blog on the internet. But apparently, you know, I've hit a nerve there, and something is coming out. I mean, this is an entity that no one's really ever heard of. So it's not like Blackwater. You've
right.
heard of Blackwater. Everyone knows who Blackwater is. but you don't know who Development Alternatives is. Well, maybe until now, if the word gets out more. This is what I call the privatization of democracy promotion, just like the privatization of, you know, the U.S. military and the intelligence community via Blackwater and others. DAI is sort of an entity that does similar services, but in what they call democracy promotion, which is just another strategy to achieve the same U.S. imperialist objectives.
Well, we just have, the time goes by so fast, and this has been a fascinating interview conversation. But in the time we have left, I'd like you to tell us about the new newspaper that you're starting, the English language newspaper that you're starting in Venezuela.
It's a very exciting development. Just last year, a new newspaper was launched in Venezuela to try to combat a lot of corporate media and manipulation within Venezuela. Most of our press actually is private. Well, all of it is print press, and most is in the hands of corporate interests or those very closely associated with the opposition. So this is a newspaper that came out last year in Spanish called the Correo del Orinoco, which is in English the Orinoco Post. It is a paper that, in fact, was created a couple centuries ago by the liberator of Venezuela, Simón Bolívar, also as a way to combat disinformation. So it's been, you know, reborn under the Bolivarian Revolution. And now we're coming out with an English language edition, which I've been honored to be named editor-in-chief of. And, yeah, it'll be actually Venezuela's first English language weekly paper that will be distributed internationally, the first one ever in history. So besides the original Correo del Orinoco, which Simón Bolívar ran during the times of independence, which was also translated to English and French and distributed internationally. So it's an attempt to combat a lot of that either lack of information, a lot of people really don't know what's going on in Venezuela, or disinformation that's perpetuated through the corporate media. And, you know, the first edition should be out by February. And it will have original articles as well as translations of some of the news articles that are produced in and printed in the daily edition of the Spanish language version. So we're looking for any interested writers to contribute as well to the paper and also to help distribute it. That's, of course, one of the most important aspects is in making sure that this newspaper reaches a widespread audience that will benefit from the information that it will produce. So, you know, we're open to that as well. And I can just give my personal email out. People can write me at Eva Gollinger. It's EvaGollinger@gmail.com or through my blog, which is ChavezCode.com, or the name is Postcards from the Revolution. They can contact me if they're interested in helping with distribution or contribution submissions to the paper itself.
Great. Eva, thank you so much for being on the show. We've been listening to the sweetheart of Venezuela. President Chavez calls you that? The girlfriend or the sweetheart of Venezuela? La novia de Venezuela?
Yes, he did call me that.
I also
in
have
2004. That's how I was branded in 2004 as the novia de Venezuela. Yeah,
that's very awesome. And also, he gave me a nickname while I was down there, Mrs. Hope, which I thought was really great too. It's always great to have such a positive nickname. So thank you for all the work you're doing down there, and we hope we can connect my listeners to your newspaper, and we hope you can be on again and give us updates about how the newspaper's going and about how the revolution's going down there in South America.
Thanks for having me on the show, and I'm willing to be on anytime.
Awesome. Thank you, Eva.
Okay. Thanks, Cindy.
That was my guest, Eva Gollinger from Caracas, Venezuela. When we come back from the break, we'll be listening to an interview that I did on Antiwar Radio with Scott Horton. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Cindy Sheehan's new ebook, Myth America 2, further examines two distinct classes of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama has declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who tragically send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose jobs and homes due to robber class graft. The robber class controls our government, and as Cindy says, we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. With pinpoint accuracy, humor, and in layperson's terms, Cindy Sheehan shows us why we should no longer be codependent with the robber class. To obtain a copy of Myth America 2, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox here at CindySheehansSoapbox.com, and I'm Cindy Sheehan. Instead of having our usual rant and Ask Cindy question, we're going to put an interview that I did with Scott Horton from Antiwar Radio in. It's a great interview, and I get to talk about Peace of the Action, P-E-A-C-E of the Action, which will be my new action that I'm organizing in Washington, D.C. in March. So listen to the interview.
And our guest on the show right now is Cindy Sheehan. She's the mother of Casey Sheehan, who died in the Iraq War back in 2004, and she's been a peace activist ever since then, and she still is. How are you doing, Cindy?
I'm pretty good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thank you for joining us on the show today. Really appreciate it.
Well, no problem. I just hope we all have a better 2010.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. In fact, I wasn't really sure when I told Angela, see if you can get Cindy. I wasn't sure whether I really want to talk to you about what's been going on for the last year or what's coming up in the next. Maybe we can do a bit of both. Let's start with next year. You told me, I guess, just a couple months back, that you're planning a big thing in Washington, D.C. in March, right?
Right, exactly.
All right, tell us all about that.
Well, we're calling it Peace of the Action, P-E-A-C-E of the Action, and you can get more information at peaceoftheaction.org. But we're planning on setting up camp in Washington, D.C. on the lawn of the Washington Monument, and it's called Camp Out Now, and we're planning on doing acts of civil disobedience every day, Monday through Friday, in the heart of the evil empire, the Washington, D.C., until our government agrees to start bringing troops home. And we're starting on March 13th. We're going to set up camp. We're inviting activists from all over to come and join us. If you can come and be a part of it for as long as it takes, or a few days or a week or whatever, we're just urging everybody to come, because we think that the time for symbolic actions are over, and we really have to start making some sacrifices and doing some pretty radical acts of civil resistance to make any kind of changes.
You know, I think part of what we're facing here, Cindy, is sort of a fatigue, you know, where, like for so many years, Afghanistan was the forgotten war. Now Iraq is, and not that the war's over, the occupation is over by any means, but it's, you know, it's almost like any other TV show or something. People just get sick of it after a while. It jumps the shark and they don't want to pay attention anymore. But I mean, the thing is, really, we owe it to these guys. You know, most people who join the military, I'm sure like Casey, they go in there based on a lot of illusions. You know, they
right.
You hear people talking about fighting for freedom. Even today in 2010, they talk about fighting for freedom as what these wars are about. And there are a lot of people who buy into that. And it's my responsibility and your responsibility and these listeners' responsibility to bring these guys home. I mean, we both know our democracy is pretty broken and that we don't have nearly the influence that we're supposed to have over it, being, you know, the people and all, but there is somewhat a democracy going on here, and we owe it to these guys. They trust us, basically, to keep the politicians from ever sending them off to die or lose their limbs over no good reason. It's our responsibility to say, like, hey, I don't care if you're bored. There's the war is still on. We have to stop it now.
Well, you know, I'm super.
I'm sorry, I'm quitting
too.
Smoking, and so I'm kind of, you know, loony.
A little grouchy. Well, you know,
the poor
I'm
last guest.
Too,
you should have heard him. He was withering under the assault.
Oh no. Well, you know, I'm exhausted too, Scott, and I want the wars to be over, and I don't want to be doing this. It's a full-time job. It's 24/7 for me, and I would love a life that didn't involve. You know, what I'm doing, being an anti-war activist. But we not only owe it to our soldiers, too, we owe it to the people of Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan and now Yemen to do whatever we can. We might be tired, we might be exhausted, but don't you think they're tired of having these occupations or these bombs dropping on them from the sky from robots? So we owe it to humanity to get it right now, as long as we can, because we do have the illusion and appearance of democracy. So let's see if we can put the Democrats to the test this year.
Yeah. I mean, that's really the challenge, right, is to make the Democrats in the House of Representatives feel such pressure that they just refuse to cooperate with Pelosi. Or maybe even she somehow can be forced to just refuse to cooperate with the executive branch anymore. No, you can't have any money. The war is over. You won't end it. We will. That's what the House of Representatives is supposed to be. I mean, if you read the Constitution, it's.
We're hoping that we will put pressure on the Democrats. And if the Democrats, you know, that the Democratic base is anti-war. The Democratic base bought into the illusion that Obama was going to be different from George Bush. So we know their base is anti-war. So let's join together to force them to do what their base wants. And, you know, they're very vulnerable already in 2010. So let's see if we can force them for once to do the right thing instead of stupidly letting the corporate interests decide what their policy is going to be.
Yeah. Well, and the generals themselves, you know. So let me ask you a couple of things here. Do you think, first of all, that there's been much progress on, cynicism? Are people yet feeling their buyer's remorse for Barack Obama? Or how long is that illusion going to last, you think?
Well, I think that there's a lot of people in the base who are already disgusted and not just disgusted, but they feel betrayed. And, you know, unfortunately, they weren't really listening to what Barack Obama said during the campaign. And so he's actually doing, in foreign policy, he's actually doing what he said he was going to do, which is so unlike a politician to follow campaign promises. But I do see a lot of dismay in the base. Like, I just wrote a piece where I was saying at the beginning of the year, after Barack Obama was elected, and I would be out speaking, people would actually walk out on me. That's never happened to me before, because I would be pointing out the similarities between Barack Obama and George Bush's policies, and people would get up and walk out on me. But now people seem to be flocking to hear people who have had the same opinion, people who have had the integrity of their position, no matter who's president. So I do see a lot of, and then we see people that are so-called in the left intelligentsia, like, you know, members of Code Pink and Tom Hayden and Michael Moore starting to show buyer's remorse in Barack Obama, which is unfortunate. I'm glad they are, but it's unfortunate to me that they're the ones who
who pushed Barack Obama down the throats of many people in the Democratic Party or even on the left.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I mean, I seem to remember pretty clearly that Mike Gravel and Dennis Kucinich were anti-war, and the rest of them might as well have been sitting on the board of directors of Lockheed. I mean, give us all a break, y'all. Come on.
Oh, absolutely. And I just think that until we, as an anti-war, pro-peace movement, get out of the notion that politicians are going to help us, that we have to be constantly on the outside being the gadflies, being the sandpaper, being whatever that we have to do to rub these people raw, to rub them the wrong way to come towards us, nothing is going to happen. And, you know, unfortunately, I wasted a year out of my life running for Congress against Nancy Pelosi, but I learned a lot of lessons in that campaign. And one thing I learned is that we have no power in the political sphere, so we have to stay outside of it, and we have to join together, no matter if we're anti-war right or anti-war left. And we're the ones that have to drive foreign policy, not the politicians.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's another very important point, is that you need cover from the right. I mean, there are more and more Republican politicians. I don't know if you can get, what's that guy, Duncan? Is it John Duncan, who gave a pretty great anti-Afghan escalation speech? I don't know who needs to do it. Maybe I can try to help. I don't know what the hell I could ever do about it. But, you know, the thing would be hopefully to try to get as many conservatives and libertarians as possible to show up for your big rally. And so to try to make it more difficult for TV to portray this as simply the liberal base, the progressive base, the left wing of the Democratic Party, because that is, according to every single person on television, that is the group of people that can all safely be ignored no matter what
right.
it is that they're saying. So, right. You know, whether I agree with them or not, they are all the example of what everyone on TV is trying to prove that they're not. Don't you dare call me one of those, you know, regular people who tends to vote Democrat. I'm a total sellout, like Bill Clinton style, DLC type, I swear. That's what they, you know. So what we need is for right wingers to say, yeah, I'm standing here with Cindy Sheehan because she's right and this war has got to stop. And then that way it makes it more, hopefully would make it more difficult for them to just say, oh yeah, you know, Sheehan and them, blah, 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 and try to write you off.
Well, we're keeping our demands very focused and very narrow because of that. It's troops out of Iraq, Afghanistan, no more drones, no more mercenary killers, close the permanent bases, and close the torture facilities. And we're not going off onto health care or the economy.
Well,
or
you're not even talking
else.
Empire in general, it doesn't sound like. You're talking about
wars. We're being very specific. Of course, most of my colleagues are anti-empire. We want all the bases around the world closed. We want our troops to come home. We want to minimize our military exposure to defensive purposes, of course. We're all for that, but we want to keep our demands very narrow to
sure.
attract a wider participation. And we feel like if we bring the troops out of Iraq, Afghanistan, and all our other demands start to be met, then that's going to start a reduction of the empire. Is it going to be reduced like this in a very sane, in a very strategic way, or are we going to have a total collapse like the Soviet Union did when they were mired down in Afghanistan? Is it going to be like Gerald Celente said in Obamageddon, or are we going to actually have a very sane strategic reduction of our military empire?
Man, you said it. I mean, right there, that is it. You know, I'm a terrible evil person. Like I told you, I quit smoking cigarettes, but it hadn't been long enough where I'm over it yet. So I'm
right.
This is, you know, the worst version of Scott you're gonna find. But right now, I'm just imagining 55 people showing up to support you at this thing, and that even includes if I could possibly go, which I doubt I'll even be able to. What is it gonna take to get, I don't know, 500,000 people to show up and just bum rush D.C. and make the whole place have to stop and say, oh, my God, I can't believe Cindy Sheehan showed up with 500,000 people. I mean, what do we got to do? I don't have $1 billion. Somebody's got to have $1 billion, right, to afford the buses, to get to hire the cold call people to get on the phones, to organize what? I don't know. I'm just a talk show guy. I don't do the organization. But there's got to be a way to make this thing. We still got a couple of months here to make this thing you know, undeniable, to make this thing the answer that they can't help but go along with, you know?
Well, first of all, the way we're planning is we don't need a half a million people. If we have a half a million people, that would be great. We're thinking 1,000 people could shut down Washington, D.C. on a daily basis in 10 different places if we make it strategic. You only need about 20 people to shut an intersection down. You just need a handful of people to shut a building down. So what we're trying to do is not, you know, that can't be, numbers can't be the judge of our effectiveness, or from the start we're going to fail, because first of all, this country's in the middle of a terrible recession. People are unemployed. You know, they don't have the resources. But then again, that's what the good thing about Camp Out Now, people can come, people will be fed, people have a place to stay, people will have a place to build community. But even if we start with 100, 200, 300 people, I'm sure as time goes on that the momentum will build and it will grow. I mean, we have a Facebook page now. It's called Peace of Action. We have 2,000 people committed on that. We have an active listserv. And I think that especially at the beginning in March when the colleges are on spring break, we have some colleges and some classes that are committed to coming and helping us get off the ground and helping us get started. But people here are feeling the effects of the U.S. empire. The chickens are literally coming home to roost. And so between shows like yours, my radio show, other people who know that it's the empire, it's our military empire that's causing this economic breakdown at home. If we can start to educate people that if we could solve these military problems in a better way, then we'll be, our economy will be better off here at home too. So it's just talking to people and having it start slow and build up. But we don't want to hinge it on numbers, because that's what they always say. Even if we had 500,000 people, Scott, come, they would say we had 10,000 people come. So we can't play the establishment game.
Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, and, you know, in any other situation, I'm against people blocking streets and all that, because it just frustrates regular people and turns them against the people doing the protesting. But in D.C., they're all a bunch of federal government employees.
Right.
And they have no feelings I'm bound to respect whatsoever, man.
Absolutely.
And so screw them.
Absolutely. No, and that's what I agree with you totally, is we're going to the heart of the empire.
The Imperial Court. That's what William S. Lynn calls it. He says Washington, D.C. is not the capital of, you know, America or anything like a republic. It's simply an imperial court, which it just has all, you know, images of everybody with a purple robe on, but it's all basically the same thing, you know?
And so we want to disturb the parasites, because that's what they are.
Yeah.
And we want the parasites out of the host, and we want true change to happen, not just symbolic actions, which the anti-war movement unfortunately specializes in symbolic actions. And we don't have symbolic problems. We have real problems that need real solutions.
Yeah. Well, okay, so tell me about, you know, kind of coordination when it comes to, because I understand what you're saying. I agree with what you're saying, especially, you know, we don't want to, you know, set expectations all high and then fail to meet them. And it doesn't have to be about numbers, depending on what exactly it is you're doing with the numbers you have and so forth. You're talking about, you know, screwing up traffic on the street, I guess, and whatever other direct actions you say you have planned there. But are you coordinating with other groups, with any part of Code Pink or World Can't Wait or Answer or any of those?
Well, World Can't Wait and Answer and Veterans for Peace have jumped on board. We don't really want endorsement. endorsements to us are meaningless. What we want are people on the ground. We want real help. We want help we can touch, not just, you know, endorsements. So we are working with groups in Washington, D.C. that have done these actions on a smaller basis and doing coordinating that way. And if people want to be involved, they can email me at action@pieceoftheaction.org. We have regular conference calls. We have organizing happening in Washington, D.C. right now. If anybody's in the area, I would love for them to help us be involved. It's an enormous project. It's something that's never been done before. And so we're going to need a lot of logistical help.
Right on. And again, for anybody tuning in late here and missed it, the giant thing is called Peace of the Action, a massive protest and direct action, beginning of a new attempt to stop the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. Cindy Sheehan's putting it all together, and it starts March 13th in Washington, D.C.
And your colleague, Angela Keaton, is very committed to organizing libertarians to help us. So if anybody wants to talk to Angela Keaton about that, too.
Yeah, that's a great idea, and her email is simply angela@antiwar.com. And, of course, Cindy just said hers is action@pieceoftheaction.org, which is the website.
P-E-A-C of the action.
Right. And again, that thing starts March 13th. So many of us are out of work because of the giant war bubble that popped and all the distortions in the market that have to take some time to work themselves out. So, hey, why not show up in D.C. and make like life miserable for the people who are making all of our lives miserable?
That's our motto.
Oh, good. 2010. Less killing in 2010. Let's shoot for that.
Exactly. And, you know, rideshare. We're going to have ride-sharing boards, and we're hoping to really build a community that just doesn't end with Peace of the Action, that keeps going to really challenge the empire to take it further and to start a reduction in the U.S. military empire.
Right on. And you know what? I apologize because I didn't mention your other website earlier. It's Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. You can find some blog entries and the radio show archives there as well.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you so much for your time, Cindy. Great luck to you. Best of luck to you.
Thank you, Scott. Happy New Year.
That was me and Scott Horton from antiwarradio.com. Well, that's it for Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. This was the first show of the new year. It was also our anniversary show. We've been on the air for a year now. It's been a year of challenges, but I think we've put together a great show. So I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my producer, Mikey. I'd like to thank my guest, Ava Golinger, and you especially for listening. So we hope you come back next week. Thank you.
I must make my witness. Have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone.
Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get...